News, I'm Tommy McNeil. British Prime Minister Theresa May suffered Tuesday the biggest parliamentary reversal ever, and the sitting government, with lawmakers including more than 100 rebels from her own ruling Conservative Party, refusing to endorse a highly contentious Brexit deal. We get more from Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda.
The Noes have it! The Noes have it! The Prime Minister!
It was widely expected that the draft divorce settlement between the UK government and European Union over Brexit would be rejected by the British Parliament. And that's what happened on a grand scale. And Prime Minister Theresa May met it with a bold move, inviting her opposition to call a no-confidence vote on her own government. In other words, she's dared them to try and get her fired.
The government has heard what the House has said tonight. But I ask members on all sides of the House to listen to the British people who want this issue settled and to work with the government to do just that.
And the Labour Party accepted the challenge. The vote's on Wednesday.
That's Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda reporting. The Islamic extremist group Al-Shabaab claims responsibility for Tuesday's attack on a hotel.
Run down! Run away! No!
The attack targeted the Ducie 2 hotel and office complex. Witnesses say they heard explosions and saw armed men firing at people on site. About 2 hours after the attack, Kenyan Police Chief Joseph Boynet emerged and spoke to reporters.
We regret to inform that today at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, a group of unknown armed assailants attacked the Ducie complex in what we suspect could be a terror attack.
That's VOA's Mohammed Youssef reporting. This is VOA News. President Trump's nominee for U.S. Attorney General William Barr began 2 days of confirmation hearings Tuesday. Barr says he's at the stage of life where he doesn't worry about the consequences of doing the right thing.
I will not be bullied into doing anything I think is wrong by anybody, whether it be editorial boards or Congress or the president. I'm going to do what I think is right.
Barr was also referring to whether he would halt or intervene in special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election. As the partial government shutdown over funding for the border wall with Mexico continues, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says a small bipartisan approach in the Senate does stand a chance of ending this.
I don't see Nancy Pelosi's teams breaking on her. I don't see Republicans breaking on Mitch McConnell. But what I do see is R's and D's in the Senate trying to produce a product working with the president that may get us out of this mess.
President Trump contended Tuesday that a new migrant caravan leaving Honduras justifies his demand for a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border to keep them from surging into the United States. While the stalemate continues, federal workers remain furloughed or required to work without pay. The United States and North Korea plan to hold high-level talks in Washington as soon as this week to discuss a second summit of their leaders following a prolonged stalemate in nuclear talks. South Korean media said this on Tuesday. Ed Giles has details.
The main topic? Probably the details of a second summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. And while it doesn't appear set in stone yet, the possible meeting does follow a recent pattern of interaction between the two sides, as Reuters' Josh Smith explains from Seoul.
There are increasing signs that U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un do want to meet in the near future. A high-level meeting between officials on both sides would indicate that both sides are trying to make more progress ahead of that meeting.
If this week's D.C. meeting does take place, the reports say they'll also work out some stopgap measures designed to push North Korea along on the road to denuclearization while waiting for summit number 2.
That is Reuters' Ed Giles reporting. Russia and the United States said Tuesday that there was no progress in talks over Washington's intention to withdraw from a 1987 nuclear arms treaty because it says Moscow is violating the terms. The U.S. side describes the meeting as disappointing. The 3-decade-old intermediate-range nuclear forces treaty bans production, testing, and deployment of land-based cruise and ballistic missiles with a range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers. President Trump said the U.S. would abandon the pact on February 2nd because of Russian violations. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 16th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. 15 people are reportedly dead and dozens injured following Tuesday's terrorist attack on a Nairobi hotel.
We regret to inform that today at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, a group of unknown armed assailants attacked the Dusit complex in what we suspect could be a terror attack.
Joseph Bonet is Kenya's police chief. Zimbabwe authorities Tuesday cut internet and social media access. Uganda's Supreme Court hears presidential age limit appeal. Rwanda's commercial court orders Anne Rwigara's family-owned company to pay over $600,000 in back taxes. And preparations are underway in Ivory Coast to welcome home former President Laurent Gbagbo and Charles Blé Goudé.
This decision made by the International Criminal Court means that President Gbagbo is innocent and all the accusations that were made on him were all false.
Jean-Gervais Chaïde is the vice president for finance of former President Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front Party. The UN appeals for nearly $300 million to tackle Burundian refugee crisis, and we'll examine women's role in Guinea-Bissau politics ahead of March election. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's post and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Fifteen people are reportedly dead and dozens injured following Tuesday's terrorist attack on an upscale hotel and office complex in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. The Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab, based in neighboring Somalia, has claimed responsibility. Mohammed Yusuf filed this report earlier Tuesday.
The attack targeted the Dusit 2 hotel and office complex. Witnesses say they heard explosions and saw armed men firing at people on site. About 2 hours after the attack, Kenyan Police Chief Joseph Boynet emerged and spoke to reporters.
We regret to inform that today at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, a group of unknown armed assailants attacked the Dusit complex in what we suspect could be a terror attack. Security and emergency services responded quickly to the incident, and we immediately cordoned off the area, and the situation is being managed, and we've made evacuation of many persons in the complex, and the operation is still going on as we speak.
Boynet said Kenyan security agencies are in the process of securing the hotel.
I would like to confirm that the ongoing operations to respond to the attack that happened at that hotel complex has made considerable progress in containing the situation, and various premises have been secured that had been taken over by the criminals.
Boynet also confirmed there were casualties from the attack and said some of the gunmen may still be holed up inside the building. Somalia-based militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed the responsibility of the attack. George Musumali is director of the Center for Risk Management in Africa.
If you look at the way this attack has been carried out, it has a hallmark of a terror attack. And remember, this is not the first time we've witnessed this kind of method being used. And we are aware that several attacks of a similar nature have been thwarted by the security agencies based on intelligence that had been received.
The attack came a day after Kenyan court charged 3 men for alleged aiding the Westgate Mall attack in 2013 that claimed the lives of 67 people and injured 150. Al-Shabaab has been involved in numerous terrorist attacks in Kenya this decade, including the Westgate Mall assault. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Preparations are underway in Ivory Coast to welcome home former President Laurent Gbagbo and Charles Blé Goudé after the two were acquitted Tuesday by the International Criminal Court, ICC, for alleged crimes against humanity. Jean-Gervais Chaïde, the vice president for finance of Mr. Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front Party, says the acquittal confirms what supporters knew all along, that Mr. Gbagbo and Goudé were innocent. He calls on prosecutors to expedite their release from further detention. Chaïde hopes the Gbagbo case will teach the ICC, which he says has always been under the influence of powerful nations like France, to intervene only when countries are not able to resolve their domestic disputes.
This decision made by the International Criminal Court means that President Gbagbo is innocent, and all the accusations that were made on him were all false. He had done nothing. Next thing is that we were right to keep supporting him despite all the problems that he was facing as a party. Because in certain circumstances, many people would have resigned. But we decided to go on supporting him, suffering all kind of discrimination from the ruling party in Cote d'Ivoire. And today we are very happy, and we are now ready for real reconciliation in the country.
When you say reconciliation, what exactly do you mean?
It means that up to now, the ruling party, they were not concerned about real reconciliation. We have said it all the time that the only political personality in Cote d'Ivoire who can do anything for this reconciliation is Mr. Gbagbo. Now that he has been released from prison, we know that the reconciliation can start and get to the point.
Do you blame anybody for the years that he has spent at the ICC?
Well, we blame the government in Cote d'Ivoire now, but we also blame France, because we all know now that it was because Mr. Sarkozy wanted his good friend, Mr. Alassane, to be in power, that he overthrew Mr. Gbagbo and decided that to send him to the ICC.
In the past elections, Mr. Gbagbo's party has boycotted the elections. Does this mean now you will be ready to participate in future elections?
Even before the decision of the International Criminal Court, we already decided to be in the next election, the coming election. So in the year 2020, we are getting ready to participate in any kind of election that will be held in the country.
Do you have any opinion on this ICC?
Well, we expected that the International Court to be not under the influence of political powers. At the same time, we are happy that this time they were courageous enough to make a good decision. So we hope that from this case of Mr. Gbagbo and Mr. Charles Blé Goudé, this ICC will be more independent, and they will take their independence from the superpowers that are ruling the world. This ICC must let countries try to resolve their problems in the beginning. And only when those countries are not able to hold their own case, then they can intervene.
Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda says that the release of Mr. Gbagbo is suspended until today, Wednesday. The people in Cote d'Ivoire, his supporters, what are you doing to plan for his return?
We hope that they will not retain him in prison again. The other thing is that we are preparing to welcome them in Cote d'Ivoire. Mr. Gbagbo has a village where his parents are having their own homes and everything. So everything is ready to welcome them.
Jean J. Vecheide is Vice President for Finance of the Ivorian Popular Front Party, former President Laurent Gbagbo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abidjan. Zimbabwe authorities Tuesday cut internet and social media access amid ongoing protests of a sharp increase in fuel prices. Believe Gaule, a central committee member of Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party, says officials made the right decision in shutting down social media and the internet after realizing that some people were spreading anti-government messages on social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and WhatsApp.
It is because of the situation that is prevailing at the moment. Things are bad. I think the government has to chip in and put some measures to stop what is happening right now. Because as it is, some people are really now embarking on doing all these other dirty things like looting and all sort of things. And these things are appearing in these social media and people are sharing that. Maybe this might also encourage other people in other areas to do the same.
But indications are that the internet is part of democracy, and in any democracy there is need for social media to actually work in certain ways. It appears now as if President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government is sort of like very repressive. So that's what people are saying. Don't you think they are right in that respect?
People are not right. People are not correct on that one. I want to really say the government is the one that provided this internet that we're talking about. It is the government that provides for its people. And it is the government that now has decided to do something about it temporarily to try and control the situation that is prevailing at the moment. And if things go like this, unchecked like this, I think it is going to give us some problems. That is why the government is now chipping in to do something.
And then people are saying maybe the government of former President Robert Mugabe was much better because it never shut down the internet. What can you say about that?
I disagree with those people who are saying Mugabe's government was better than Emmerson Mnangagwa's government. Remember, it is the same government that gave us bond barrier checks and this bond note that you are crying foul about. It is the same government of Mugabe that created all these problems that we find ourselves in at the moment. So I don't think it's correct. Right now, as we speak, the government is really embarking on reviving the economy. At the same time, it's a pity that people have decided to go destroy property and loot other people's property. It's really a pity. And this is really going to derail some of these things, the program that the government is rolling out.
Balif Gaole is the Central Committee member of Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party. He spoke with Gibbs Dube of Viewers Zimbabwe Service. Today is Wednesday, January 16th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Uganda's Supreme Court Tuesday began hearing an appeal against the constitutional amendment on presidential age limit. Some members of parliament and activists want the court to quash the judgment of the Constitutional Court, which upheld the amendment. One senior opposition leader says failure to annul the amendment may lead to what she calls a lifetime presidency. Mugumi Davis Rakarinch reports from Kampala.
In his submission to the Supreme Court Tuesday, civil activist Mari Mabirizi told the court that the parliament flawed laws by allowing parliamentarian Rafaeli Majezi to table the motion to amend the constitution. Mabirizi said there was no proper consultation with citizens as required by the law. He also said the military presence at the parliament deprived members of a free debate.
If you don't comply with the law must be set aside. This violence surely tormented the people. You beat people, you arrest them, and then come back in the evening and say that now I'm giving leave to Majesty to bring a bill. That was violence.
Soldiers were involved in a brawl with some members of parliament as they forcefully tried to evict them from the parliament. The bill was approved after a majority of parliamentarians, mainly from the ruling party, the National Resistance Movement, voted in its favor. Last year, activists and some members of parliament's plea to the Constitutional Court to annul the constitution was not granted. Elias Rukwago, the mayor of Kampala, who is representing parliamentarians, agrees with Mabirizi. He says the move to amend the constitution was aimed at extending President Museveni's rule.
That law was not passed for the good of the country. It was not passed in good faith. The transgression of the rules of procedure, rules, the provisions of the constitution by the speaker, they are all been highlighted.
The amended law grants the incumbent, who will be 75 years in 2021, a chance to contest again.
The current constitution seems to be an empty shell, a paper tiger, because the safeguards that were put there have all been removed, meaning that actually a country without a durable and stable constitutional order is more or less like a failed state. So now the ball is in the court of the Supreme Court to see how that issue can be addressed to get this country from the brink of collapsing.
Winfred Chiza, the former leader of opposition in parliament, is one of the parliamentarians that was opposed to the removal of term limits.
Now that we are going into the same circle of leaders not wanting to leave the space when time comes and they change goalposts, I'm not being a prophet of doom. But all I can tell Ugandans is that we are going back to the old times, where anybody who feels must take on leadership of the highest office then must use the force that Museveni came with. And Mr. Museveni should be ready for that music.
President Museveni came to power through a guerrilla warfare in 1986. The government attorney general will today, Wednesday, present his reply to the case. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Rwanda's commercial court on Tuesday ordered Henry Gara's family-owned Premier Tobacco Company to pay over $600,000 in back taxes. A judge ruled that Henry Gara, who manages her family business activities and her accountant, mismanaged the company and so it was not able to pay taxes as far back as 2012. As Eugene Uwimana reports from Kigali, the Rwanda family says the fine is politically motivated.
Anugigala spent at least 15 minutes hearing the verdict of the Kigali Commercial Court. She was the only defendant in the courtroom. The Rwigara family has been battling with the Rwandan Revenue Authority, which accuses the management and shareholders of Premier Tobacco Company Limited, PTC, of mismanagement, which the authority says resulted in the company's failure to pay nearly 6 billion Rwandan francs, or about $6.8 million in tax arrears dating back to 2012. The Rwanda Revenue Authority says Anne Rwigara and other PTC managers lied about taxes in 2017. But according to Anne Rwigara, the verdict is a bad decision. This verdict saddens us, but we still have 30 days from today, so we will appeal. The Rwanda Revenue Authority says it filed a lawsuit against the Premier Tobacco Company shareholders because the company itself does not have anything else to auction. This is after the authority auctioned off machinery from Rwigara's family PTC for almost $2 million. The authority also auctioned off more than $500,000 worth of processed tobacco. The Rwigara family problems with the Rwandan government started around 2015 when a prominent businessman, Rwigara Assinapol, died in a car accident. His family alleged he was murdered for ending business ties with the Rwandan government and consequently out of favor with President Paul Kagame. Assinapol Rwigara was a known financier of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which was then the Rwanda ruling party during and after the Liberation War. Anne Rwigara said that apart from killing their father, the Rwandan government illegally invaded and took over their properties. May God pardon you. You don't know what you are doing. You are working for the murderers. After killing our parent, now you are using laws to take his fortune. But Richard Tusabe, the Revenue Authority Director General, said that the auctions were legal and not politically motivated. President Paul Kagame won international praise for restoring stability to Rwanda after the genocide in which over 1 million ethnic Tutsi and politically moderate ethnic Hutus were killed. However, human rights groups say he has suppressed the potential democratic opponents. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The UN Refugee Agency and 35 partners says $296 million is needed this year to provide life-saving assistance to 345,000 Burundian refugees living in desperate conditions in neighboring Tanzania, Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, and Uganda. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of Burundians are going hungry because food rations have been cut for lack of money. It says the health of many people is on a knife's edge because medicine is in short supply. It says schools are overcrowded, with many children missing out on an education. It says shelter is inadequate. The UNHCR says Burundian refugees are in dire straits because the world pays scant attention to their plight and responds poorly to appeals for aid. Agency spokesman Charlie Yaxley says children, who make up more than half of the refugee population, bear the brunt of this serious underfunding. He says many children have become separated from their families while fleeing from Burundi. He says many are traumatized from the violence they have witnessed. He says there is little money to provide them with the psychological and social care they need.
Women and girls are suffering high levels of sexual and gender-based violence and exploitation. Last year, food cuts were implemented in Tanzania, DRC, and Rwanda. Families have been regularly left without enough food to last until the end of the month. And this has seen women and girls resorting to negative coping mechanisms, including survival sex and forced and early marriage.
Conditions in the camps are so bad, Yaxley says, a number of refugees are opting to go home. He tells VOA about 57,000 Burundians have returned since the middle of 2017. The security situation overall has improved. Nevertheless, he says an average of 300 Burundians a month continue to flee the country.
And they cite persecution, harassment, and fear of attack as their reasons for fleeing. There's also reports from those fleeing of food insecurity as well. So we do urge states to, first of all, continue providing asylum and open borders to those seeking international protection.
The UNHCR says it does not believe conditions in Burundi are currently conducive to promote returns. It adds that nobody now should be returned to Burundi without his or her full and informed consent. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Parliamentary elections in Guinea-Bissau are set for March this year, and this will mark the first time each party is required to have 36% of their candidates to be women. One of the backers of the new law and also parliament member for the ruling party, Susie Barbosa, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the need for more women in Guinea-Bissau's government.
I was one of the members of the parliament that defended this law, because I think it's a question of justice. In Guinea-Bissau, the women will represent 52% of the population. But unfortunately, in the parliament, we were only about 13.3%, less than 14%. And the worst is that last year, it has been even worse. The representation has been around 11%. So we decided that we should have a law that would increase the number of women in politics, in all the voted places in politics, not only in parliament, but also in regional government.
Because of the most recent elections, it being such a low percentage, has it been difficult to find women to run for these places, or are there abundance of women?
No, it's not difficult. The thing is, most of the time, women are demotivated. They are not motivated to participate, because they realize that most of the political parties use them for the campaign, but after, to make the list, they won't put them. But thanks to this law, they will be forced to have women in the list.
You touch on something very important, I think. Women are oftentimes the primary mobilizers for these candidates, the primary mobilizers in their communities. It kind of mirrors just the idea that women also do a lot of the labor at the house that is maybe not appreciated and things like that. So,
yeah. Exactly.
What kind of resistance did you get?
Yeah, it's not easy. Speaking about the labor's work, in our country, in Guinea-Bissau, women represent only 25% of the public administration service. That means that 75% of the public service is made by men, which is not fair. Being a majority also should be represented in the public services. This is just for you to have an idea. This is something cultural. It has to do with our culture barriers that usually they don't allow women to have the same opportunities in school. And that reflects also in the formation of the government and also in the administration. They should have a voice and they should be heard, because it's a part of the society that remains outside decisions.
And how do you think this can benefit Guinea-Bissau as a whole? Because it's really not about just benefiting women, but the country.
You know what we think? It has been proved. It's not only ours. It's most of the countries that have more women represented in governments, in decision positions. They have better development politics. Why? Because women are more worried about education. Women are more worried about health. They are more worried about maternal health. So when we have more women represented in this kind of position, you also have better development policies. And this is what we're trying to have. Because now, to vote any law in parliament, being a parliament of 102 members of parliament, only 14 are women, it's very difficult to have something approved.
That was Susie Barbosa, a lawmaker in Guinea-Bissau. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Bissau. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. 15 people are reportedly dead and dozens injured following Tuesday's terrorist attack on an upscale hotel and office complex in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. And that is it for this Wednesday, January 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Botti in Washington.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.